Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. It's good to be here tonight. I love this meeting. I remember when this meeting first started. It was a real breath of fresh air to have this type of a format, to have people sharing messages of depth and weight. It was just a great thing. I'm glad it's continuing. I am an alcoholic. I understand what that means today. It took me a while to really understand what an alcoholic was. I knew I drank a lot. From the first time I started drinking, from the first drink I had, it was quite obvious I wasn't doing this the way most people would. There was an intensity about my drinking. The first time I can remember drinking, me and a couple of my friends cut school. And we went back to my house, and the plan was to get drunk. You know, I mean, we planned it. We were about 13 years old, 12 or 13. We did that. We went back to my house, and I poured out three big water glasses of Four Roses whiskey, and we all started drinking it. And the two guys I was with had about half of the glass, maybe a little bit more than half a glass. And they quit. They'd had enough. You ever drink with people that have enough on you? Yeah, you know what I mean. No thanks, I've had enough. Like, what? You know, that doesn't even compute for an alcoholic. So they'd had enough on me, and they sat back and they watched the show, because what I did was I finished off my glass, I finished theirs off, I finished the bottle off, and I got just slamming drunk, blackout drunk. Now, you know, I'm like 13 years old, and I'm in a blackout already. And, you know, that was what my drinking was going to look like for the next 20 years, believe it or not. You know, something about alcoholics and alcohol, it's impossible to learn a lesson. Because what happened was, after I drank all that Four Roses whiskey, I woke up, I came to from that, and I was about as sick as I'd ever been in my life. Remember your first hangover, drunken, you know, sick, puking, just, you know, not able to get off of the horizontal plane for like 2 days? And that was me. I don't think I'd ever, you know, I experienced projectile vomiting for the first time. You know, it was really something. And you know, I mean, I was horribly sick, horribly sick. Now, if anything but alcohol, if I would have had a food or you know, something like, if I had eaten a rutabaga and gotten that sick for 2 days, you know, there would have been no problem. I never would have gone near it again, ever. You know, I wouldn't have had to join Rutabagas Anonymous in 20 years, you know, and get a rutabaga sponsor. You know, and share my rutabaga abstinence, you know, every year, and get a coin. I mean, it wouldn't have been necessary, because I would have had an adequate mental defense against eating rutabagas. It wouldn't have been an issue. But there was a special issue with alcohol, and I believe it started like this. You know, there was this great speaker who got sober in the 40s. He died like in 1982, but he was an amazing speaker. He really changed the way people spoke at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. His name was Chuck C. And he was from California, and he was the first guy that I've ever discovered who would get up and not tell a drunkalogue. He would do a spiritual talk. And in one of the spiritual talks, I heard him say that he believed that there was only one problem, that we as alcoholics only had one problem, and within that problem were all the other problems that we had. And there was only one solution, and within that solution were all the solutions we would ever need. And the problem was separation from God, and within that problem is all the other problems that the alcoholic has. And the solution is connection to God, and within that solution are answers to all of our other problems. Now, when I first heard him say that, you know, I didn't get it. You know, today I do get it. I do get it. And I'm looking back on my life before I discovered alcohol, and this is basically what it looked like. I remember the terror I had the first day of kindergarten. you know, the first day I was on my own, you know, my mother, you know, said, hey, there's that kindergarten, you know, go to class. And I remember just being terrified. I can still remember this. And all the way through school until I was 12 or 13 years old, I was always acting as if I didn't have this anxiety. I had like this social anxiety. What it was self-centered fear. And self-centered fear is one of the main symptoms of alcoholism. You know, and that sense of separation that Chuck C. talked about, that was me. From the very first, my very first memories, I felt apart from, separate from, different than, and not connected to the things that I needed to be connected to. And when I discovered alcohol that day that I started drinking the Four Roses whiskey, what happened was, after the first glass, I started to get a nice warm feeling. After the second glass, you know, that's when it happened. That's when the magic happened. That disconnection from God and the universe disappeared. That anxiety, that social anxiety that I had was gone. I felt larger than life. And, I wasn't afraid of anything. I wasn't worried about anything. All of a sudden, I felt okay. And I really believed that I had discovered the magic potion that was going to allow me to feel like I thought all of you guys already felt like. Because it just seemed like everybody's doing fine and I just have to act like I'm doing fine because I don't want to look stupid, but there's something really wrong with me. So that's why even getting violently ill the first time I drank Four Roses whiskey, why I went back to it. Because here's what happened. Warm feeling, a feeling of larger than life where everything is connected and everything is wonderful. And then I turned into a vomiting pig. But I remembered that period of time in between warm feeling and vomiting pig as wonderful. You know what I mean? And I continued to shoot for that for 20 years. And I would constantly allow myself to be overserved. You know how that happens. Now, so here I am. I'm a budding alcoholic. I'm planning on where I'm going to drink. I'm planning when I'm going to drink. I'm figuring who's going to be there. You know, where am I going to get the money? What am I going to drink? I mean, I became very, very preoccupied from a young age. As soon as I hit high school, you know, my first thoughts were becoming preoccupied with drinking. They were all also becoming preoccupied with the non-conference approved substances that some of us have messed around with over the years, and I was also involved in all that. Alcohol was there first, alcohol was there during, and alcohol was there after all the smoke cleared from these drugs, though. I was alcoholic. And looking back on my history using some of these drugs, I see that I was using them either for the same reason I was drinking, from freedom from Chris, or else I was using them to help manage my alcohol consumption. You know, there were periods of times when I would use uppers to keep drinking. There was periods of time when I'd use benzos to get over the hangovers. It was all trying to manage, you know, my alcoholism. And I'm thinking back. I'm sitting outside with my friend Paul here. Paul, I went to high school with Paul, so he remembers some of these times. And we were talking about the great Quaalude epidemic of 72. And I'm going to tell this story because Paul's here. Now, what happened was our friend John comes to school, and he was like one of the dealers back then. And he brings in this big sack of pills, and he puts them down. And we're at the smoking area before first period. And everybody's gathering around. What's he got now? You know, and he goes, well, we're going, what are those? And he goes, they are Quaaludes. And we're like, well, what are Quaaludes? Oh, they're good. You know, well, how much are they? $1. Well, sell us some. So about 50 of us are buying these Quaaludes. And he hadn't done them yet because his brother gave them to him the night before to sell. So when we asked him, how many do you take? He goes, two or three. Oh, my God. For anybody that doesn't know what Quaaludes are, because they're so illegal now, because, you know, people on ludes should not drive. I mean, what happens with a lude is you take a lude and your head's fine. But when you go across the room, you break every piece of furniture on the way across the room. It's just you can't control. So what happens is about 50 of us take two or three of these Quaaludes before first period. It was a debacle. It was really bad. I mean, the ambulance was back and forth all day long. People were passing. I remember by third period, I was walking down and holding on to the lockers like this, trying to get down to my clip. And finally, I can't take this. I got to get out of here. And I look and I see an exit sign, right? So I go, exit. All right, you know, I'm gonna exit. And I head for the exit. And I remember going across the field and into the woods. And when I get in the woods, there's people already out there. They're hanging on the trees and stuff. You know, I finally make it out there. Now the next day at school, there's all these people that are laughing at me. I'm like, what are you laughing at me for? And they're like, dude, man, when you broke for the woods, you know, the whole 400 wing watched you. And I'm like, so? He goes, it took you 5 minutes to go 100 yards. I'm like, I thought I was hauling ass. Oh, man. Those were bad. But I'm also thinking, you know, Paul and I would go to the same bar for lunch during high school. This is back when the drinking age was 18, and we made quite a good use of that. It's now 21, and you don't have drinking period in high school anymore. But we sure did. Anyway, you know, there was some good times. There was some good times. I'm not going to say that every single time I drank it was terrible, or we didn't have some fun. But when I look back on it, I look back on my life during that period of time. I wasn't making the right moves. I mean, as I'm watching, friends of mine are going off to college. They're getting married. They're getting decent jobs. You know, they're getting credit and being able to buy cars, and all that stuff passed me by because all I really could focus on was like getting through a bad day at work at a bad job and drinking. And there was no more dealage available, you know, for me. So what happened was I kind of came to. At 32 years old, you know, after 20 years of drinking, I come to it 32 years old, living in a room at my mother's house, because that's kind of what macho guys do, you know what I mean? My marriage had blown up, I'd lost my driver's license like multiple times, and I'm drinking for what it says in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm drinking for that oblivion. You know, in the chronic critical end stages of alcoholism, the alcoholic is compelled to drink massive amounts of liquor. You know, when you're looking at step one, this is how step one is described in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's described as having a physical craving, an allergy to alcohol, which is a physical craving. How that works is, the first drink always does one thing. It asks for the second drink. And the second drink insists on the third, and the third drink demands the fourth. What happens in the metabolism of an alcoholic is, the more alcohol in your body, the more alcohol you want. And that's why I always, almost always, became a tongue-chewing, knee-walking, not able to operate my own pants zipper drunk. Because I would just drink as much alcohol as I possibly could and I would pass out. And normally when I would pass out and I would come to, I'd have a full gigantic glass of bourbon and Coke. You know, with like 5 or 10 shots in it. Like, why in the world would I pour a drink that big if I'm about to pass out? It was because that craving. I wanted more. Now, that wouldn't be so bad if it wasn't for the obsession of the mind. The book Alcoholics Anonymous takes like 30 pages to describe this because a lot of times we're not going to buy this. This is a part of powerlessness that is very difficult for us to accept. And that is, at certain times the alcoholic does not have a mental defense against the next drink. There's no power, there's no choice, there's no control. We can't just say, I'm not going to drink anymore. How many times have we said that? How many times have we meant it? I swear to God I'm not going to drink anymore. I swear to God. And if we were hooked up to a lie detector, the lie detector would say, you know what? This guy is telling the truth. He's never going to drink again. And we're drunk that night. You know, what is that? That's the obsession of the mind. The way it's been described to me by a medical doctor who's an addictionologist is basically like this. We have different thought processes in our mind. And certain things take precedence over other thoughts. It's like survival instinct. It's like the alligator mind. And what will happen is you'll have the thought like, well, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink because I can't get another DUI. I'm not going to drink because my boss will fire me. I'm not going to drink because my wife will throw me out of the house. I'm not going to drink because if I do, you know, I'll have a dirty urine and I'll go back to prison for 10 years. I'm not going to drink. All of a sudden the thought, well, you know, I really should drink because of this reason, will leapfrog over all those other good reasons and take precedence. So all of the good reasoning, and you know, we just passed the lie detector, we're never going to drink again, and all of a sudden we're drunk. We don't have control over that thought process. We are without defense against the first drink. And this is really hard for anybody to understand, and it's also hard for a lot of us to admit to. You know, that's what, to be powerless over alcohol, which is what it asks us to admit to in step one, you have to be powerless over the amount you drink once you start drinking, and you have to be powerless over putting it in your body, or else you're not powerless. If those things aren't true, then just don't drink and you're going to be fine. But that's not what happens to us. What happens to us is the time and the place comes and we put alcohol back in our body. And that's very, very difficult to understand. Here's my personal experience with that. 20 years I've been drinking. Okay, I totally know that if I continue to keep drinking, I'm going to die. Alcohol is slowly taking me out. My eyes are yellow in the morning. I'm seeing yellow eyes when I look in the mirror from liver failure in the morning. I don't even have hangovers anymore. When you drink like I did, they aren't hangovers. It's alcohol poisoning. You are poisoning yourself with ethyl alcohol. That's what it is. It's, you've poisoned your body. It's not a hangover. It's, you're dying. You know, you came really close to dying and you backed that, you passed out, or else you would be dead. So that's really the way I was drinking. Now think about this. You can't control alcohol once you start. You can't control starting. You know, those are a couple of big problems. But that's not even the end of step one. The really bad part of step one is after the dash, that our lives had become unmanageable. You know, in the short form that you see up on the wall, it talks about your life becoming unmanageable. But in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, there's different examples of what that unmanageability looks like. And what it looks like in the book is exactly what I was suffering from in between my drinks. Now, you know, the problem for me was feeling uncomfortable, feeling disconnected from. That feeling grew, and sobriety became untenable for me. And the only relief I could possibly have is like between drink 8 and drink 10. I mean, you know, that pre-oblivion state of being that we get into when we drink. That was the only place I was comfortable anymore in my last years of drinking. But there would be periods of time when I was not drunk. It was usually when I was working. And it talks about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that we are restless, irritable, and discontented until we can again, once again, experience the sense of ease and comfort that comes from taking alcohol into our system. On a good day, I was restless, irritable, and discontented. You know, on a bad day, I was prey to misery, depression, self-centered fear, anxiety, guilt, shame, remorse, you know, total depression, sometimes suicidal thoughts. That was like a normal day. on a really bad day, like after I'd come to in the morning with a summons in my pocket for another DUI or something, it would be pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And this is what the book, and this is in a sober state, this is what the book is talking about. And our problem is with sobriety. Alcohol is a solution to our sobriety. And that's what I had wrong. I really thought I was coming into Alcoholics Anonymous to stop drinking. If I stopped drinking, everything would be fine. And this is what some people were telling me. Well, let me tell you, when I stopped drinking, things were not fine. Things were very far from fine. I was a lunatic. I was a lunatic in my mind. I mean, Bill and Bob, when they were putting together, you know, the literature, and when they were putting together the processes in the very early Alcoholics Anonymous groups, understood that you do not fight alcoholism with sobriety. They'd all tried that. It only lasts a certain amount of time, and then you get drunk again. You fight alcoholism with spiritual living and the spiritual exercises that bring about a spiritual awakening. And this is a marvelous thing that they discovered, because there was something really wrong with me just staying sober. You know, I'm thinking back on in the 80s where Nancy Reagan would say, just say no to drugs. Say no. Are you kidding me? Listen, if you're going to tell me not to drink, if you're going to tell me not to do drugs, you better be offering me something else. Because sobriety is not even close to enough for me. It's never going to be. I need a shift in perception. I need a change in personality. I need to be looking at life with a whole new pair of glasses. Or I am not going to make it. Because I shake myself to pieces. Here's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. All right. I used to go to this one liquor store in Baskin Ridge, New Jersey, and I knew exactly where my vodka was if I was drinking vodka. I knew exactly where my bourbon was if I was drinking bourbon. And I made sure that the guy who owned that liquor store was not going to be running out of my stuff. Okay? And my, you know, my modus operandi was I would fly home from work. I had a bad job as a bad electrician. And I would fly home from work in my $100 car. And I would pull into the liquor store and I'd run in there, I'd grab my vodka, you know, I had my money ready, I'd throw it down on the counter and I'd get the hell out of there and I'd get the hell home and I'd start drinking. And this one, I remember this one day, there's a lady who's talking to the guy who's supposed to check me out. And she's doing this, she's going, well, what kind of wine goes with tilapia? And I'm like, you know, like, what the hell? And the guy starts talking to her. Well, you know, there's this Chablis from the California vineyards that has a marvelous blush, and it's supposed to be really wonderful with white fish. And they're going back and forth, and I'm like, are you crazy? Are you crazy? There's a lady who wants to know what kind of wine to drink with fish. I gotta buy this vodka. Are you all nuts? Just give her a bottle of Gallo and get her the hell out of here. All right? I need to buy. I got a problem here. I got a problem. I'm sober. You know, get this lady out of here. Now finally, you know, she got some crap ass wine to take home to cook her tilapia with, and she got the hell out of there. And I was able to buy my stuff and get home. So, you know, I get home and, you know, and I'm walking, I crack the top, just cracking the top of that bourbon. I'm like, ah, you know, and pour it into the glass with the ice and a little bit of Coke. And I start, ah, okay. Now, is my problem alcohol? I don't think so. My solution is alcohol. My problem is sobriety. I can't take it. Now, if you're working on the wrong problem, you're working on the wrong solution. If you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and somebody tells you just don't take a drink and everything will be fine, and you think just not taking a drink is the path to the solution, which is everything is fine, and you're an alcoholic, it's gonna be a scene, okay? You're gonna be, you know, they're gonna nickname you relapse, because that's the wrong problem and it's the wrong solution if you're an alcoholic.
What you need is a spiritual recovery program. That's why this is a 12-step organization. That's why the 12 steps are, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the steps. That's what our literature says, and I know that that's what they mean. You know, one day I was getting in an argument with a psychiatrist. He's somebody on a LinkedIn group. I do a lot of stuff with the professional community around addiction and alcoholism treatment and theory and things like that. And I'm in an argument with this guy. This guy pissed me off because, listen, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. Much of my life in the last couple of decades have been wrapped around Alcoholics Anonymous and you people and the friends that I've made and the people I sponsor and the experiences that I've had. Love AA. Well, this knucklehead psychiatrist writes in there something really bad about Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I'm like, you know, whoa, buddy. You know, so I throw a couple of zingers his way. And he writes me back, and this is what he says. He goes, I don't recommend my alcoholic clients go to AA anymore. AA's success rate has been shown to be about 6%. I could get better results with a placebo. This is what the guy writes. I'm like, oh my God, you know, the professionals are now telling people to stay away from us. Now, I was furious and I wanted to call him a meathead and everything, but I had to think about what he said, because a little bit of what he said is true. Where and how they get the statistics is basically they go to big meetings in metropolitan areas and they stand outside and they ask, you know, they poll the people that walk through the door. And truly, people that are walking through the door in these big city meetings, they probably have about a 6% chance of being there in 2 or 5 years. That's about right. So I had to think about how I was going to go back at this guy. And this is basically what I came up with. I asked him this question. I go, okay, let's say that you've come up with a solution to a certain type of cancer. And you just know that this works. And you set up shop in a hospital and you have 100 people with that particular cancer come and you are going to treat them. And what happens is 100 people come, but 90 of them sit in the waiting room and talk about their cancer and share about their cancer and get a sponsor about their cancer. And they're grateful they have cancer, but only 10 of those 100 people go in for the operation. I go, would you say that your procedure is only 10% effective? And he sends me back this answer. No, only the people that would you know, take the procedure. I wouldn't count any of the people unless they took the procedure. I go, well, you're counting the people who are going into AA who have not taken the steps. You know, thoroughly, we've never seen a person, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed the path. There's a lot of people that just come in and think a program is taking up a seat in the meeting. And it's not. Taking the 12 steps is the recovery program. So I believe that, yes, 6% of us, if you walk through the door, are going to be here in 2 to 5 years. But I still believe rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I still believe that that's true. Because that's what I see. You know, the people that I work with who stay with me are people who go through the steps. And they're always around afterward. They stay around. The people who, you know, see going through the steps with Chris as an overreaction to a problem that they kind of really have under control, those people are always gone, you know. So I believe that statement. Rarely have we seen a person fail. Now, here's me in year one. I had a horrible relapse. I signed myself into a treatment center. I got to the treatment center. I got into an outpatient program, and I was going to AA because that's what my counselor, you know, recommended when he gave me 10 minutes in 30 days to talk to me. That's what he told me to do. So that's what I did. I'm going to 2 AA meetings a week. I'm going to 2 outpatient meetings a week. I've just been through 28-day rehab, and I've told everybody I'm never drinking again, ever, ever. You know, what more do you people want? And on the way to an AA meeting, the thought crosses my mind that if I buy a gallon of vodka and I drink it, it'll improve It'll improve my attitude to this whole AA thing. Because I'll feel so bad that, you know, I'll rush back and, you know, I'll do the whole deal like with a renewed sense of enthusiasm. So I do. I do. I buy a gallon of vodka and I start drinking it to improve my sobriety. Okay? There's a reason we get sponsors. And there's a reason we pass things by sponsors. Because this wasn't necessarily a smart thing to do. Because what happened was for 7 months, it was the bleakest, most horrific relapse. I can't even imagine. It was decadence, you know, with a turbocharger attached. It was horrible. And at the very end of this, you know, Christmas at the Schroeders, I'm still at my mother's house, and it's Christmas when my brother comes home, my sister comes home, there's nieces and nephews, and there's, you know, family animals, and they're playing the piano, they're playing Christmas carols, and there's a Christmas tree with presents underneath it, and the stockings are hung by the chimney with care, and Chris pulls out a handgun and threatens everybody's life. I'm going to kill all of you! You know, because what did you say? You know, I'm going to drunken blackout, and I'm going to kill them all, and they take their Christmas elsewhere. Well, when I started piecing this together, I got to tell you, you want to talk about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and going into the DTs, it was absolutely awful. I remember, you know, fish flopping on the floor because I'm heavy into the DTs and I'm hallucinating. I didn't sleep or eat or hold down any water for about 4 days. And I remember hallucinating. There was things scratching on the house to try to get in, and there was animals running around. What the hell was that? You know, and there was maggots all over the couch covers, and there was marching bands playing. And I'll never forget, I'm looking up at the ceiling trying to get comfortable, and a big devil comes out of the ceiling at me. He's going to come down and eat my face. I remember, I'm like, no, my God, God help me. You know, I'm totally, you know, completely out of my mind. You know, I come out of this a little bit, and I remember calling my family and saying, I tracked him down to my sister's house, and I go, you got to come home, I don't want to die alone, you know, I really, you know, my, you normally, not normally, but at least 15% of the time, with these kind of DTs, you die from them, and I knew I was in really, really bad shape, and I remember asking my family to come home, because I didn't want to die alone, and they said, no. We don't want to have to see you die. We're going to stay right here, thank you. Get on with your business. And I did. And I remember coming out of that and thinking, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous kind of was, didn't really work for me, but I don't have any other answers. Maybe if I go back to AA and I put more effort into it, maybe that's what I need. But I didn't want to die. And I had a daughter at this time. My daughter was about 7 or 8 years old. And I didn't want to die in disgrace and leave her that kind of legacy. So you know, I had a little bit of motivation to try to stay alive. So I remember, I can picture this. I haven't slept in 4 days, but I'm going to an AA meeting. So, you know, I'm crazed out of my mind. I find a meeting book, you know, and I'm looking through it. And because of my car, I had a 1976 Ford Granada with white walls, busted quarter panel, no clutch, no emergency brake, no heater core. You turn on the heater in the winter and squirt antifreeze on the inside of the window. It had no muffler. It was a piece of crap. It was like, you know, because we're busy, you know, it didn't have inspection, had fictitious plates. I mean, it was just this horrible piece of crap. And to be able to get to a meeting, it had to be flat. So I had to look for a flat meeting because the car wouldn't go up hills. So I find a flat meeting in Morristown, and I drive over to Morristown, and I get there, and it's the 6 o'clock Church of the Redeemer meeting. And I thought it was a beginner's meeting. I thought I read it to be a beginner's meeting. Well, what it was a step meeting. But anyway, as I'm pulling into this church, I have to go up this little hill to get into the parking lot. And now picture this, I got no muffler and no clutch. So I got to gun this thing to get up the hill. And I got to drive by about 75 alcoholics out on the stoop having a cigarette. So I go, you know, I get about 1 mile an hour. The car gets up the hill, and I literally have to park it against a tree because there's no clutch and no emergency brake. You can't stop it from rolling. So, you know, they're all looking at me like, must be a new guy. You know? Yeah. You're darn right. And I remember walking in, you know, I'm walking in and I'm terrified. My head is telling me this is dangerous. Oh, my God. You know, people are looking at you. You know, oh, get out of there. But I knew it was like my only hope. So I get into the meeting and I go up. The only place open is in this one row. So I sit down and I'm thinking, okay, I'm sitting down, And, you know, the meeting started, somebody's talking, okay. And this lady from my left taps me on the shoulder. I look over, right, and she hands me a step book. And she goes, we're reading from step 12. And I grab the book, and I look, and they're reading. They're reading paragraphs, and they're coming down the row at me. Oh, my God! I'm going to have to read. You know, so I get up and I leave. You know, I got to read. I'm out on the porch and I'm smoking a cigarette. I'm thinking, this is too much. I don't know if I can do it. It's too much. Make me read. And somebody comes outside. This guy, Jorge. He saw what was going on. Thank God. And he came out and he goes, hey, my name's Jorge. You know, what's your deal? I'm like, oh, he's Christian. He got all these big relapses. The magnets. It's just demons coming out of the ceiling. I'm vomiting. Horrible. And he goes, well, come on back into the meeting with me. You know? I'm like, oh, so is there a meeting tomorrow night? You know, I'll go to this meeting tomorrow night. And he was smart enough to know what tomorrow means. You know what tomorrow means for the alcoholic? Tomorrow means never. So he's going, oh, come on. He's pulling me in the air. So, all right, I'll go back to the meeting. We go to the meeting and we sit down. The only place left is like in the second row. And we sit down, and now there's people sharing. You know, somebody's sharing. There's a couple of people up front running the meeting. Somebody's sharing. And he leans over to me and he goes, raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back. I'm like, tell me, come back. There's a meeting tomorrow night. Everybody raises their hand. Everybody comes back. And he's going, no, raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back. And he's starting to get loud. And I'm looking around. People are looking at us now because he's getting loud. You know, they're going to be thinking at me soon. You know, I got to do something to stop this. So I've never seen it happen before. I've never seen it happen after. Right in the middle of this woman sharing, I raise my hand. You know, and the guy who's leading the meeting is like confused. He's like, and he tells the woman to shut up. And he calls on me. And I say something really profound, like, I'm going back, this is hard. The animals, the marching bands, this is hard. Thank you. And it's dead quiet. Everybody's like... And then all of a sudden, they all start cheering, yay! Like the whole meeting's going, yay! And, you know, I took it as acceptance, you know, at the time. Now I know it's like, oh my God, the poor bastard. Holy mackerel, thank you so much for sharing. I came here with some problems, but after hearing you, oh my God, I'm fine now, you know, thank you. You know, oh my God, you pathetic bastard. But, you know, here's what happened. I had an inability to connect. In Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I couldn't talk to you. I couldn't share. I can be honest. I couldn't take your phone number and call you. Good God, what would I say? Imagine, you gave me your phone number in the meeting the other night. You know, my life totally sucks, and I thought I would just share some of that with you. Drag you down into the hell that's my life for a few minutes, you know, and make myself feel better. You know, is that okay? I mean, you know. What are you going to do? What are you going to say to somebody? So, you know, I didn't do any of that. And after I raised my hand and I was able to say I was coming back and everybody clapped for me, what it did was it knocked down just enough of that wall of self-centered fear to enable me to come back the next night. You know what I mean? And I got to tell you, we are here by seconds and inches, some of us. You know, there are small little decisions that we could have made that would have blown us out of here. And there are small little coincidences that grabbed us and pulled us in a little bit further. And these are amazing, amazing things. And I got to tell you, I'm forever grateful for this guy, Jorge. I find out later he's got 2 weeks sober. You know what I mean? This guy, he came out and saved my life at 2 weeks. He didn't know any better, you know? My God, but... So I started to go to AA, and I started to do what I really thought you were supposed to do. Just don't drink and just go to meetings. And I did that. And I've got to tell you, my mind was crazy back during these days. It was all I could do to go down into a church basement and sit there and listen to the meeting. You know, and I started to get to know some people, and some people started to get to know me, and they're being fellowshipy, and, you know, Chris, how you doing? Oh, I'm doing great. I'm doing fine. You know, typical answer. But in my head was just absolutely insane. I'd be sitting in a meeting, and here's basically what it would be like. I'd be saying, oh, God, did you hear that guy share? Oh, my God, what a hypocrite. Oh, man, he's full of crap. Oh, no. So-and-so's raising his hand. Oh, my God, no, please. No, don't call him. Don't call him. Oh, my God, they called on him. Now I'm going to have to hear about him, share about his family. Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, now he's grateful. Now he's grateful. Oh, isn't that wonderful? I'll tell you what, I'll go out, I'll slash all four of his car tires. I'll follow him out into the parking lot to see gratitude in action. That's what I'll do, you know. And, thanks for sharing. You know, I mean, I was insane. I was trying to stop a semi with a cobweb by just sitting in a chair in AA. Man, I had alcoholism coming at me, and I'm just trying to stay sober. Well, this one guy, he was like my first friend in AA. He was the first guy that had enough nerve to, you know, try to do something socially with me besides just going to meetings. And we started going to meetings together for a while. Radio Shack Mike. Well, Radio Shack Mike was one of these guys who was into, like, the New Age bookstores, and he's always reading the new Louise Hay book or The Road Less Traveled, and he's always sharing about how wonderful all this stuff is. And he comes to me one day, and he gives me a set of tapes, like 8 90-minute cassette tapes. And he goes, I didn't particularly care for these, but, you know, you're hardcore. You might like them. I go, well, what are they? He goes, well, there's a couple of guys, Joe and Charlie from Arkansas. They do a big book study. Like, big book study. Joe and Charlie from Martin. 8 90-minute tapes? What are they talking about? You know? Is it because they talk real slow? You know? Like, a boy named Joe. I'm going to have to speed them up. You know, if they're from Arkansas. You know? But I listen to him. He makes me promise. So I listen to him. And, you know, I put these tapes in. And I start listening. And I'm pretty horrified. And I get a resentment almost right away. Because I know what these guys are talking about. I know what they're saying to me. I know what they're implying. Okay? That they're basically saying, Chris, you know, you've been treating the three sides of the triangle. You've been going to meetings. You're in the unity side of the triangle, but you're not doing any service, and you don't have nothing to do with recovery. So this isn't going to work for you. Don't tell anybody you're working an AA program, because what an AA program is it's following the directions in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what an AA program is. So you know what? And you're not doing that. So when you come back, you know, when you come back, don't tell, you know, when you go back out, don't tell people that AA doesn't work, because AA is these 12 steps. The fellowship is in support of the 12 steps. And I get a huge resentment from these tapes right off the bat, because we don't have big book meetings, and our sponsors don't take us through the steps, and I, you know, this is another language that I've never heard that I'm hearing from Joe and Charlie, and I get a huge resentment, and I put them off on the shelf. Now I go through some more sober bottoms. I didn't have any emotional sobriety or emotional recovery. So what would happen is the littlest things would set me off. And what happened was I lost my job. I broke up with a girlfriend. You know, a state caught up with me because I fled to avoid prosecution or some stupid thing, you know. And all this stuff hits me at once. And you know, I'm completely out of my mind. But I decided to go back to these tapes. I didn't have a better plan. I certainly didn't do it, you know, out of any sense of virtue. I did it from a sense of I don't want to feel bad anymore. So what I did is I took these tapes back down. I started playing them. I blew the dust off my big book. I had a big book that I hadn't opened since treatment. And, you know, I open it up and it's got all these signatures. Did anybody in here ever go through treatment and have people sign your big book? This said something like, Chris, you crazy bastard, you'll never make it. Love, Harry. You know, I mean, all these things like this. But anyway, I blow the dust off of it, and I start listening to these tapes, and I start going through the tapes. And when it says to do something, I do it. And when it says to take a spiritual exercise, I take it. When it says to go out and do something, I go out and do it to the best of my ability. Didn't do a great job, but I started to go through the steps. Now, here's the thing. Here's the thing that I had to internalize. If Joe and Charlie on these cassettes were right, every single person in every meeting I was going to was wrong. That's what I had to come to the conclusion of. Because in New Jersey, at this period of time where I was going, we shared. That's how we stayed sober. We shared. Yeah, so, you know, going over to somebody's house, going through the steps, knocking on doors, making amends. No, nobody was doing that, or I wasn't hearing about anybody doing that. Sometimes it's the receiver and not necessarily the transmitter that's broken. But I had to come to terms with Joe and Charlie from Arkansas are right, and everybody in North Jersey that I've met is wrong. I had to come to that conclusion. You know, and it was not easy because I loved my sponsor and I loved my home group. And I had a lot of really, really great people I was hanging out with. But they were all clueless as far as practicing a 12-step program because it wasn't fashionable in that area at that period of time. So I got through that. I got through the steps. By this time, I started to sound good. You know, I was able to give good share. I knew just how to do it because I'd been in enough meetings. You're a little self-deprecating and you insult yourself just a little and you tell people, you know, look, funny little stupid things you did, ha ha ha, I was so silly today. And they love you, you know. And I, you know, I learned how to give share like that. And so people were asking me to sponsor them. And I had a bunch of people. And I was kind of sponsoring, still, I was kind of sponsoring the way my sponsor sponsored me. Here's my phone number. Give me a call. I want to see you at meetings. You know, be a coffee maker somewhere or find a service commitment. And that's kind of what I was doing. And they were drinking on me, most of these guys. Most of these guys were drinking on me. You ever have people drink on you? You know, that you're sponsoring? It makes you look bad. You know, you lose status. You know, is Harry yours? Yeah. Well, you know, he's drinking and hitting on the new women and borrowing money. Yeah, I'll talk to him. You know, there was a bunch of guys like that. You know, just meatheads that I was sponsoring. And I decided one day that, you know, what I had done with the Joe and Charlie tapes and the big book, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get people over to my house and we're going to open a big book on page one and we're going to go through every word and where there's an exercise to take or an instruction. We're going to do it together and this is how I'm going to sponsor from now on. And that's the way I've been sponsoring for over 20 years now. And again, does everyone go through the steps like that? Not everyone. Does everyone that asks me to sponsor them even get to my house to start to go through the steps? Not always. But I got to tell you that there's a contingent of mad dog people who actually do this and actually recover from alcoholism. And you know, I'm grateful. I got hooked in with and I got exposed to some really, really amazing people in the recovery community. I've met some real heroes. I got to meet the people who I listened to in the early days on the tapes and become friends with these guys. And that was really amazing. And, you know, my life has just gotten incredibly, incredibly good over the years. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. You know, that is absolutely still true today. It's absolutely still true. The fact of the matter is, though, is there's a huge amount of people, a majority of people who are in Alcoholics Anonymous who don't actually take the 12 steps. If I could change anything in our literature, I would put actually in front of every single one of the 12 steps. Because I know when I was coming around, I was going to a lot of step meetings. And in those step meetings, you kind of got the feeling that as long as you agreed with these steps in theory, everything was good. You know? But that's not true. That's not true. I used to go to this one step meeting, and this guy drove me crazy. Because he would start practically every share like this. Yeah, my name is so-and-so, and I haven't done this step formally, but I'm going to share for 10 minutes about what I think it might be like if I ever did. You know, and I'm going to hold all you hostage to my opinion. And, you know, I'm like, oh my God, how do you know what you don't know, though? You know, until you have some experience with these steps, you're going to think that all you need to do is agree with them in theory, you know, and I work my program and I keep it simple. I'll bet you do. You know what I mean? I'll bet you do, Clem. Oh, my God. In the early days, I've done a lot of historical study of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the early days, this is what it looked like. You'd hear about Dr. Bob or you'd hear about Bill, and you'd get a meeting with them, and they'd put you immediately in the hospital, whether you needed it or not, because you need to be convinced that you've got a medical, serious condition. And then what they would do is they would send people in to 12-step you to tell you their story, one right after the other, a whole bunch of them. And when they finally thought you were about ready to make a decision, you know, a third step decision, they'd do it with you, and then you'd immediately start doing a fourth step, and that same day you would be sent out to make amends, and you would be doing prayer and meditation in the morning with groups of people, and immediately you would be expected to work with multiple people every week. This is like you're a week sober and you're supposed to be sponsoring people. And that's what it was. That's what it was like in the first 10 or 15 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's become too easy because of the amount of meetings. Bill Wilson used to say all the time, the good is sometimes the enemy of the best. And you know, having a meeting on every corner, that's a good thing. But the best thing for us alcoholics is to have a spiritual awakening and then to carry that message to other alcoholics. Because that's really what puts horsepower in our recovery. It really does. That activity, that action that we take trying to help other people. When you go to Alcoholics Anonymous to give, when you go from going to Alcoholics Anonymous to get, and you finally shift your perception to going to Alcoholics Anonymous to give, you know, you're well on your way to that spiritual awakening, that personality change at depth. That will offer you recovery from this seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. There are a ton of promises that are offered us. If we work for them, there are a ton of promises. The one thing that I've always seen is as much effort as we put into Alcoholics Anonymous, we always get more than that back. You know, if you have the opportunity to sponsor people, pay attention to the chapter Working with Others. Pay attention to the fact that this is a spiritual recovery program, and to get the recovery part, you have to do the steps. You are not going to recover from alcoholism by going to 3,000 meetings. You need to do the steps. Meeting attendance does not treat alcoholism. Meeting attendance puts us puts us close to the sunlight of the Spirit. Taking the steps puts us directly into the sunlight of the Spirit. We must always know that we are not the sun. I'm at the hour. Thank everybody for being here. Thank you.